At the end of that last paragraph, I fell asleep, and I'm sure you can understand why. But I awoke this morning to a magnificent piece of news. One of our men, name of Yancey Quimper, by a feat of arms which he says was extraordinary, has captured Santa Anna, and we have him now in a tent being guarded by 7. Otto and I and all the men around us wanted to kill Santa Anna, and we were downright angry when General Houston treated him like an honorable foe, giving him better food than we're getting. I was one of a committee of 6 who met with Houston and told him, "We want to hang that man." But he reasoned with us and said, "Our battle is only half won. Bigger ones may lie ahead, and I plan to use Santa Anna as our principal cannon." My friend Otto would not accept this, and when he told General Houston what he himself had seen at Goliad, and how his own father had been run down like a coyote, tears came to General Houston's eyes, and with his forefinger he traced the scar on Otto's face and asked, "Did you get that at Goliad?" And Otto said, "I did, sir, killing a man who was trying to kill me." And Houston said, "It is your badge of honor, son, and mine will be to treat Santa Anna better than he treated us." Tonight I am very afraid, sir, and I hope that you will pray for me, and for Otto, and for all the brave Texicans who fought so many with so few. For if the Mexicans assemble their armies in this area, they could still overwhelm us. It is rumored that if I survive the next great battles, I shall be entitled to many acres of the best land in Texas, and this is a country with a potential for greatness. Inform Miss Betsy Bell, if you will, that she should start now to prepare the things she will want to bring to Texas. For Otto tells me that he once traveled along some excellent land on the Brazos River, and he will show me how to claim on it. If I live, sir, I shall post haste to Mississippi and marry Miss Betsy Bell the morning I arrive, and please to inform her of same. Your loving son in God, Martin. P.S. Do not tell Mother or Betsy Bell about the knife work in the swamp. They might not understand. Ascot's report of Quimper's heroism in capturing Santa Anna did not reflect the truth. On the morning after the battle, Quimper and 2 buddies, one a young fellow from Kentucky named Sylvester, had quit trying to capture Mexican survivors and were hunting deer for the mess. When they saw 6 or 7 bucks suddenly take flight for no apparent cause, Sylvester, a skilled huntsman, said, "Something spooked them deer." And when they investigated, Yancey saw a man huddling on the ground and trying to hide in some bushes, dressed in old clothes. He was about to shoot him when Sylvester shouted, "The battle's over, for Christ's sake. Let him live." "Get up, you swine," Yancey shouted. But the quivering man remained on the ground, whimpering. The men dragged their prisoner into camp, and he would have been thrown into the ordinary compound, except that sharp-eyed Yancey saw several Mexicans begin to salute. "Stop that," one man commanded his fellow prisoners, but it was too late. "He's a general, by God," Yancey called. And when the man was shoved forward, the Mexicans in the compound began to kiss his hands and call him El Presidente. "We've got Santa Anna," Quimper shouted, and he spent the rest of that day parading about the Texican tents, announcing himself as the man who captured Santa Anna. Otto, who was near General Houston's cot when the Mexican general was brought before him, heard Santa Anna's first words. "Congratulaciones, mi general, ha derrotado el Napoleón del Oeste." "What did he say?" Houston asked. Otto translated. "You have defeated the Napoleon of the West. Tell him to sit down." Houston had more difficulty with another visitor, Mrs. Peggy McCormick, owner of the farm on which the historic battle had taken place. "Tell me, who's going to bury all these dead bodies cluttering up my place?" "We'll bury the Texicans," Houston replied graciously as he adjusted his throbbing leg. "How about those hundreds of Mexicans?" "Why, madam, your land will be famed in history as the spot where the glorious battle was fought." "To the devil with your glorious victory. Take off your stinking Mexicans. That's Santa Anna's problem." She demanded to see the general, And when he was produced, she asked him in Spanish, "And what do you intend doing about all those bodies?" And he replied, "The fortunes of war, madam, I can do nothing." The true miracle of the Battle of San Jacinto transpired some days after it ended, because a greater danger persisted than the one Houston had conquered. The Mexicans had under arms in Tejas some 5,000 of their best troops, led by skilled generals, Felicilla, the Italian, Vol, the Frenchman, and Riparda from Yucatan, who had joined forces with Urrea, the victor at Goliad. If they coalesced, and they were not far separated, they could drive Houston right to the borders of Louisiana and annihilate him if they overtook him. But now Houston's brilliance showed itself. For by the force of his remarkable personality, he kept Santa Anna alive, appreciating the fact that if he allowed him to be hanged, as most of the Texicans wished, the man would become an instant martyr, a hero who had to be avenged, just as the martyrs of the Alamo and Goliad had had to be avenged. But if he could be kept alive, a prisoner in humiliating disgrace, his martyrdom would be avoided. Also, he would be available to issue orders to the other generals to disband their troops and go home. As dictator of Mexico, he would still command their obedience. So with a skill that Metternich or Talleyrand would have applauded, this Tennessee card sharp used Santa Anna the way a long-practiced fisherman uses a fly to trap a trout. He coddled him, he flattered him, he even arranged for him to be sent to Washington to interview the President of the United States. But first he obtained from him orders to his generals to go home. Miraculously, they obeyed. This powerful army, which could have won so many battles, dislodged so many plans, supinely obeyed their imprisoned leader, when the whole tradition of war dictated that they ignore any command issued by a man in the clutches of an enemy, and took their men quietly out of Tejas, which would know that lovely Spanish designation no more. It was now Texas. By the merest thread of chance it had become Texas, and so it would remain. Of the three men from the Victoria dog runs, each lost his battle. Campbell at the Alamo, McNabb at Goliad, and Garza in the swamps at San Jacinto. But each contributed to the grandeur upon which the Republic of Texas was founded. For the living, the fortunes generated by this battle were both mundane and dramatic. Yancey Quimper appropriated the title Hero of San Jacinto. Peggy McCormick, in the years following the war, earned tidy sums from selling the endless battle mementos scattered across her farm. But both Pamela Mann and Juan Seguin ran into trouble. After the war, Mrs. Mann moved to the burgeoning town of Houston, where she ran the Mansion House, a disreputable hotel noted for its brawls, duels, and repeated police raids, which she handled deftly with her two pistols. However, an especially blatant disregard for the law resulted in a court trial, and she received the death sentence. It was commuted because of her bold behavior during the war. Seguin started out famously as the mayor of San Antonio, but his tenure was turbulent, and he fled to Mexico. Later, he returned as a member of a Mexican invading army that captured San Antonio and held it briefly. A strong opponent to union with the United States, he did his best to make Texas once more a part of Mexico, and died disappointed at the age of 83. Benito Garza, languishing in a prisoner of war camp, had to relinquish his dream of ever becoming Gobernador de la Provincia de Tejas. He spent his idle hours brooding over his opposition to the Texicans, an obsession that would intensify and never abate. And Joel Job Harrison acquired the right to conduct Methodist services openly, which he did in wooden churches he established in various parts of the new nation. Immortality was visited upon the least likely participant in the battle. Emily Morgan, who had diverted General Santa Anna's attention that hot afternoon just before the charge of the Texicans, became celebrated in song as the Yellow Rose of Texas, and few who sing it in romantic settings realize that they are serenading the memory of a mulatto slave. Meteoric was the rise of Mirabeau Bonaparte Lamar. The 25th of March, 1836, returned to Texas. The 20th of April, private foot soldier. The 21st of April, cavalry colonel. 5th of May, Secretary of War in the cabinet of President Sam Houston. 24th of June, Major General. 25th of June, Commander-in-Chief of the entire Texas Army. 5th of September, Vice President of the Republic. And even greater glories lay ahead. And Otto McNabb went his quiet but very determined way. Task Force. As soon as the staff announced that our December meeting would be held near Houston at the monument marking the Battle of San Jacinto, we members decided that for this important session, no outside authority would be imported. Instead, we would invite the general public to a convocation at which we five would be seated at a table with microphones. Each would offer a brief opening statement regarding the significance of the Texas Revolution, after which the visitors would be invited to make such observations as they wished or pose questions that bothered them. We anticipated a lively meeting with perhaps 24 local history aficionados who would know more about San Jacinto than we did. It was our hope to make them feel that they had shared decision-making regarding their schools. But when we approached the monument, there she stands, 571 feet high, taller than the Washington one. We found a line waiting outside and standees crowding the inside. "What's up?" I asked a guard, and he said, "The experts you invited are here, but so is this mob. They're waiting to see Ransom Rusk." And when I asked why, he said, "They've never seen a real live billionaire." But a woman who overheard this corrected him. "We want to see Lorenzo Quimper and his boots. He's such a dear." When the last person had been wedged into the hall and loudspeakers installed for those outside, I opened the session with brief remarks, commending the condition of the monument and reminding visitors that when our meeting ended, they would be served punch aboard the battleship Texas, moored nearby. Unique among our great warships, the Texas patrolled the coastline during 5 major landings in World War II. Texans like to participate in major events. Miss Cobb started our presentation with a reminder that when Texas patriots defended their rights in 1836, they not only won their own freedom, but also set in motion those currents which would, a decade later, secure liberation for New Mexico, Arizona, and California. The geographical shape of the United States today was ensured by the heroic actions of a few Texicans who resisted General Santa Anna's brutal oppressions on this very field. Ransom Rusk told the audience, "I think we must recognize that even if the Texas Revolution had not occurred, states like Arizona and California might have stumbled their way into the Union because of local conditions. In the case of Texas, it was essential that some kind of stable buffer be established between the Anglo-dominated Mississippi River and the Mexican-dominated Rio Grande. During the 19th century, we provided that buffer, and at times we seemed more like a separate nation mediating between two larger nations than a typical American state like Virginia or Ohio. And I think that Texas will always have that peculiar character. It's a part of the United States, unquestionably, but it has its own personality, something unique and wonderful, which the rest of this nation needs." Lorenzo Quimper, recognized by the crowd as a descendant of the hero of San Jacinto, rather neatly downplayed his ancestor's performance, while at the same time implying that without the heroic Yancey, the battle would probably have been lost. Starting out with what he called "my highfalutin Texan," he sounded like Pericles delivering his oration on the grandeur of Athens. "On solemn days like this, when we celebrate our great victory, we must remember the true character of the Texicans who won freedom for us. 5 times they faced the Mexican army, and 4 times they lost by tremendous margins. Alamo, Goliad, Santa Fe, and the Mir expedition, crushing defeats which might have disheartened the bravest. But mixed in with those defeats was a resplendent victory, San Jacinto." Here the audience broke into cheers, which encouraged Lorenzo to relax his speech a bit. Us Texans have always had that basic character. We can absorb one defeat after another. Drought, plague, financial collapse, heartbreak and loss in the Civil War, misbehavior of elected officials. At the height of his impassioned oratory, he hesitated for just a moment, half smiled and added, "Even losing in football to Oklahoma." When the crowd stamped and whistled, he dropped into pure ranch hand Texan. "But us Texans, we always recover. Fact is, we don't never know when we're whooped, which is why we so seldom get whooped." Il Magnifico was the hit of the show, the authentic voice of Texas. Efrain Garza took a more somber approach. "My ancestor fought at San Jacinto, too, in the army of Santa Ana." Silence. "So it is highly probable that the early Quimper faced the early Garza that day, perhaps right where we sit." Suddenly he shot out his hand to grasp Quimper's. "But now we're friends. We're one people." The crowd cheered and stamped again. But, as so often happens, the battle settled only part of the problem that had caused it in the first place. It determined, as Miss Cobb has so accurately stated, that a huge corner of Mexico would ultimately become a part of the United States. More applause. But it did not decide how the new addition would be incorporated. What theory of law would prevail? How would Mexicans like my ancestors, who had lived here for many generations, be received in the Union? And how would their rights be preserved? Some of these questions still wait to be settled. These last remarks were not well received by the patriots gathered to honor the Texan victory, because every Anglo in the audience, and the audience was 99% Anglo, believed that the questions Garza raised had been settled. So I felt it incumbent upon me as chairman to come to Garza's defense. "We wanted a Hispanic spokesman on our task force, and, as you can see, we got a good one." Two people clapped. "Every battle has aftermaths, both for the victor and for the loser. Professor Garza has identified some of those which still perplex our state. And now we will accept questions or statements from the audience." To my disappointment, the first man to rise was not one of the local experts. He was a belligerent rancher from South Texas who got us off to a miserable start. "If Professor Garza don't like how we handled affairs after San Jacinto, why don't he go back to Mexico where he come from?" I pointed out that since Garza's family had lived in Texas for a much longer time than any other family represented this day, Texas was where he came from. But that did not satisfy the protester. "If he's Mexican, he accepts the rules we lay down. San Jacinto settled that." Eagerly, I searched the audience for a more gracious speaker, and my eye lit upon a woman who had written two small books about the San Jacinto area, and she asked, "If Mexican troops defeated us four times, and we defeated them only once, why was San Jacinto so determinative?" And Quimper had a prompt answer. "Ma'am, quite often it depends on timing and luck. When we won at San Jacinto, Santa Ana was far from home base and getting worried. Psychology, ma'am, sometimes it turns the tables." A Houston oilman, a friend of Rusk's, had for some years supported scholars working in early Texas history, and wanted to know, "Was this battle as important as you claim?" And Ransom responded, "I admitted in my opening remarks that great historical currents were already underway, which might have carried part of Mexico into our orbit, whether we won here at San Jacinto or not. But the magnitude of those currents and their ultimate significance were intensified by our victory. It caught the imagination of the American people. It showed a light in the darkness. It stimulated the later concept of manifest destiny. It made conquest to the Pacific inevitable." Important, Tom? It was far more important than I stated. It was the major gift of Texas to the United States. It awakened patriotism, and the idea that we Americans had a duty, a responsibility, to bring democracy to the entire continent. Tom persisted. "I was taught that those things came as a result of the Mexican War in 1846. "They did," Rusk agreed almost eagerly. "But remember the irresistible sequence. The Alamo led to San Jacinto. San Jacinto led to a free republic. The free republic led to 1846, and 1846 led to the United States boundaries as we know them today. And never forget, Tom, it all started with a handful of the bravest men this land ever produced, who said at the Alamo, "We will die rather than surrender our freedom." He paused. "They said it, Tom, and they did it." The crowd roared its approval, and Rusk added, "That may still be our major gift. Courage. Optimism." Another woman asked, "Why do you men always claim it was only men who made the difference?" And Quimper replied, "Because in battle, ma'am, it's the men who do the job." But Miss Cobb interrupted, "That's a cogent question, madam, and in my book our Mr. Quimper's other ancestor, Matty Quimper, who seems to have done most of the work, who kept her family afloat when her husband was away, and who finally destroyed her ferry and burned her inn to keep them from the Mexicans, was a greater Texas hero than her son Yancey, who captured Santa Ana when the battle had already ended." Several women applauded, and after acknowledging their support, Miss Cobb resumed, "Texas has always underrated its women, and I suppose it always will. Therefore, we must, when it's appropriate, remind our men, as you have just done, madam, that we too helped build this state." Quimper leaped to his feet. "Let me tell you, I'm just as proud of Matty Quimper as I am of her heroic son Yancey." The women applauded this generous concession. After 20 minutes of similar statements, a thoughtful man rose and said, "I'd like to return to that first question. What patterns will the Anglos and the Mexicans devise for sharing our state? And I'd like you to answer, Mr. Chairman." I spent nearly a minute with my hands folded over my chin, for I realized that this meeting would be the first to be widely reported, and I did not wish to damage our task force before it was well launched. I wanted to say exactly the right thing, so, facing the 2 television cameras, I spoke carefully. I could well be the only person in this hall whose ancestor fought in the Alamo. Moses Barlow marched from Gonzales to die there. So I've had to contemplate your question many times, sir, and I've concluded that no heavier cloud threatens our state than our reluctance to define the future relationship between the so-called Mexican and the Anglo. This uncertainty keeps us fragmented into unwarranted cells, and I see no solution to this ugly estrangement. This morning we've heard 2 conflicting views. Critical battles settle everything, or they settle very little. The truth is that a successful battle can sometimes establish general direction for several decades, but basic, long-term results evolve slowly, inevitably, remorselessly. San Jacinto determined that Texas would be ruled in the immediate future by Anglos and not Mexicans. But the long-term relationship between the two groups is far from settled. Are you saying that the Mexicans might ultimately take over? Not at all. What I'm saying is that Appomattox determined that the North would establish the rules for our Union for the next 100 years. The North would set the freight rates so damaging to the South. The North would determine the tariffs that made it so rich and kept the South so poor. The North would determine everything, it seemed, and would do so perpetually. But look at the situation today. Where is the power flowing? Always to the South. Where are the seats in Congress coming? To Texas and Florida. Where would you like to live if you were young and active and hopeful? Vermont or the Sun Belt? The audience cheered. Battles can be terribly important. Thank God we won, and not Hitler. I'm glad that in the Far East we decided things, not Japan. No man on this earth ever fought a more just war than Chester Nimitz of Texas did in the Pacific in 1943. This brought more cheers. But look at Europe and the Pacific today. The losers in battle are the victors in peace, while the victors seem to be losing. and that's because it is not the climactic battle, but the slow, inexorable force of history that determines the future. We had discussed these historical truths for some time when a wiry man in his 60s rose, caught my eye, and then made a statement so startling that few who heard it could believe. I'm proud to be here today in the presence of Lorenzo Quimper. My grandfather fought beside Yancey Quimper on this field in 1836. Did you say your grandfather? I did. I'm Norman Robbins, born 1922. My father was Sam Robbins, born in these parts in 1879. His father was Jared Robbins, born in 1820, aged 16 at the battle. That's right, a woman who specialized in genealogies called from a back row. The two Robbins men married late. Suddenly, Texas history became very real, and we looked in awe at a man whose family bridged so many great events. How young the state of Texas seemed at that moment. No one in Massachusetts had a grandfather who had fought at Concord Bridge, but Norman Robbins had heard from his father a first-hand account of the launching of Texas. Miss Cobb snapped us out of our reveries. Let's go to the battleship for our punch. And as we walked across the field, we could almost hear the rifles firing, because the fighting seemed so recent. Rusk, walking with his friend, the Houston oil man, said, "Our state contains hidden powers which manifest themselves in unexpected ways at unexpected times." And he led us on to the Texas. Chapter 7. The Texians. When the sovereign nation of Texas, standing completely alone and allied to no one, inaugurated Sam Houston as its first elected president, Otto McNabb was 14. Thus, he and the new republic would grow up together, and the major problem of each would be the same, to find a home. Otto, one in which to attain that love and security he had sought since first seeing those lights shining across the Ohio River. Texas, a secure place within the family of nations. It was a natural affiliation, Otto and Texas, because the two had much in common. Both were self-reliant, both tended to solve problems with the gun, both believed in simple, forward action rather than in philosophical speculation. Both were suspicious of Mexicans and despised Indians, and both vaguely wanted to do the right thing. Most important, both entertained lofty aspirations they could not always voice or define. It would be a lively decade as these two matured. The nation quickly found that conducting a successful revolution was relatively easy compared with organizing a stable society thereafter. Along a hard-drinking frontier, it often seemed that the major problem was to find any official who was sober, President Houston being especially addicted to the bottle. Nevertheless, the fledgling nation made a series of critical decisions which helped establish its permanent character. Fiercely Republican and abhorring the dictatorial chaos witnessed while part of Mexico, it decreed that its president would be allowed to serve only 3 years and then be required to sit out a term before being eligible to run again. Clergymen were forbidden to serve in the legislature, and slavery was not only permitted, but protected. No free Negro shall reside in Texas without consent of Congress. The basic attitudes of the nation could be summarized in a series of adjectives: individualistic, aggressive, volatile, rural, egalitarian insofar as white Anglo-Saxon Protestants were concerned, and often violent. But the overriding characteristic during these early years would be national poverty. Texas had the bad luck to start its history as a free nation, just as financial panic paralyzed the United States and slowed down transactions in Europe. With no solid economy on which to construct a currency and minimal trade on which to levy taxes, the poverty-stricken republic stumbled along, always on the verge of bankruptcy. And since the United States had no paper money or coinage to spare, Texas had to depend upon the most dubious banknotes issued by entities not much more solvent than it was. Currency issued by states like Mississippi and Arkansas circulated at 50% discount, with only the more solid notes of New Orleans and Alabama retaining a value of 100 cents to the dollar. Mexican money was good, but most prized of all were the notes of Great Britain and France. Even so, the rule among merchants was, if you take money in before 11, pass it along to somebody else before 5. Of course, Texas did try to float its own paper money, but the result was disastrous. Issued at 100 cents on the dollar, it was immediately discounted to 80 cents, then to 60 cents, before it stabilized at about 50 cents. And that was the so-called solid dollar backed by collateral. But the nation did have one sovereign currency which kept it afloat. Millions of acres of unassigned land, and it employed the most ingenious devices for turning this land into cash. It gave free acreage to anyone who had served in its armed forces. It lured residents of the United States with roseate promises. And it hired a firm of New Orleans speculators, Toby and Brother, to print and sell certificates entitling any purchaser to a spacious homestead. The history of Texas in these formative years was an account of how men without money used land to keep afloat. In the social life of the Republic, there were subtle changes. People began dropping the name Texican. They became Texians. Spanish accents on some words were eliminated, and names simplified, so that the old Bejar became Bayer. Bayer became San Antonio. The Rio Grande lost its accent, and all other Rios lost not only their accent, but also their Spanish designation. Henceforth, they would be rivers. The lovely word arroyo became creek, as if to symbolize the transition from Spanish lyricism to Kentucky realism. Poetic family names like Trevino became Trevino for the Anglos, and the music was lost. To facilitate administration, counties had to be established, and in time, almost all the heroes participating in the battles were honored by having counties named after them. Austin, Bonham, Bowie, Crockett, Fannin, Houston, Lamar, Rusk, Travis, and all but Travis also had towns named in their honor. To the delight of future schoolchildren, Deaf Smith's county would retain his full name. The names of certain famous places also became enshrined as counties. Bayer, Goliad, Gonzales, and Victoria, with San Jacinto following later. The first named was awarded an area much larger than many European nations. From Bayer County, in decades to come, well over 100 normal-sized counties would be carved. By this lavish display of honors, Texas served notice that it took its history seriously and sought to enshrine its nobler moments. Massachusetts and Virginia produced many national leaders, but they did not become the warp and woof of existence as did the heroes of Texas. Pennsylvania had its Valley Forge and New York its Saratoga, but they never became a living part of their region's religion the way the Alamo did in Texas. From the start, the new Texians proclaimed, and in a rather loud voice, "Look at us, we're different." Among the counties formed in the first flush of victory was one named after Zave Campbell, whose exploits atop the wall were recited by both Senora Mordecai Marr and Joe, the Negro slave belonging to Colonel Travis, both of whom were spared by Santa Anna. Both told of Zave's Ajax-like defense. But the most telling testimony came from a Mexican captain who said, "There was this tall old man whose name was called out as I bore down upon him. Xavier, watch out," someone shouted as I ran him through. And when we counted the dead bodies of our soldiers around his feet, there were 9. It was agreed that Xavier County should be established west of the Brazos River, but how the name should be pronounced was not so quickly settled. Older settlers who spoke Spanish wanted to call it Javier, with accent on the last syllable, but newcomers promptly changed that to Xaver, with accent on the second. Within a few months, it was agreed that the county was Xavier, with a heavy accent on the second syllable, and so it became. Like many of the early counties, and like more than half of those that were to follow, Xavier County had no principal town. There was a miserable crossroad settlement of 9 houses called Kemble, and it was designated the county seat. But it would never dominate thinking or become as important as the county it served. A settler rarely said, "I live in Kemble." He almost invariably said, "I live in Xavier County." Young McNabb became one of the first new settlers in Xavier. Reluctant to return to Victoria and a Mexican way of life with his adopted mother and aunt, he jumped at the invitation when his companion-in-arms Martin Ascott proposed, "Let's take our free land side by side along that river you told me about." And when this was agreed, the Mississippian said further, "Otto, let's go to Galveston and meet the ship when Betsy Bell arrives." In his battlefield letter to his father, he had promised to go to Mississippi to claim her. But the problems of land acquisition had become so demanding, and in unforeseen ways so complex, that he had sent her an ardent letter. "I simply cannot leave Texas now. It would be more practical for you to come here, and we shall marry as you step off the steamer." So off the two friends went, down the Brazos River in a flat-bottomed scow, then up to the fledgling town of Houston, where they reported to Buffalo Bayou for a sailing ship, which carried them across the wide bay to Galveston, the principal settlement in the Republic. They were standing on the improvised dock when Betsy Bell's schooner braved the treacherous sandbar that both protected Galveston's harbor and sank unwary ships that could not find the only safe passage. As soon as Otto saw Betsy Bell, in her blue hat with streamers and white dress with ruffles, he knew he was going to like her, for she looked both like a young bride and like the future mother of children. "You're lucky," he whispered to Ascott. And he felt even more approval when he stood beside Martin as the Galveston minister intoned the marriage ceremony. When the clergyman, a Methodist with bright eyes, told Martin, "You may kiss the bride," Ascott did so, then told Otto, "You must kiss her too." And the 14-year-old boy, blushing furiously, did so. The three partners, for so they termed themselves, spent only 2 nights in Galveston, for they were eager to locate and take up residence on the land the government was giving them for their service at San Jacinto. Purchasing 3 horses with funds from the dowry Betsy Bell had brought from Mississippi, they rode the 88 miles back to Xavier County, where Otto identified the land he wanted the partnership to claim. And both he and Martin stepped off the 640 acres side by side to which each was entitled. When across the fields, riding a very small donkey, came an old comrade who was about to save them from making a serious mistake. It was Yancey Quimper, shouting, "Wait a minute, wait a minute." And when he halted his donkey, he gallantly raised Betsy Bell's hand to his lips. "All Texas is honored to receive such a beauty from Alabama." "Mississippi," Betsy Bell said. "What are you men doing?" "Locating our 640s, Ascott replied. 640s, Quimper exploded. And before the day was out, he was leading his friends to the county seat at Kemble, where his good friend Judge Finnessy, formerly of the Arkansas bench, would be certifying land entitlements. During the trip, Yancey brought his friends from San Jacinto up to date regarding his fortunes. "Many people consider me the principal citizen of Xavier County," but what exactly he did, the travelers could not discern. At 24, he was what rural people called a fine figure of a man. Tall, rather fleshy, and pale of complexion. He seemed to lack strength, as if one or two critical bones had been omitted. But he offset this by a warm, radiant smile that he flashed at anyone he wanted to impress. He was always dressed in accordance with another ancient truism, clothes make the man. And he had lately purchased a big Mexican hat with a very broad brim. It was precisely sized to match his build, so that when he came picking his way down the dusty streets in Kemble, he proclaimed himself, without speaking, to be our leading citizen. He had been raised by his Tennessee father to speak rather good English, but after the death of his parents, his association with the rude soldiers of the Revolution had encouraged him to acquire their informal speech habits, so that now his sentences were colorfully ungrammatical and his words those of the barnyard and ranch. But he spoke with marked effectiveness, often and loud. As a verified hero of the battle in which Texas had won her freedom, he felt himself entitled, and sometimes obligated, to express his opinion on almost everything. But he did so with such an attractive mixture of gravity and wit that he did not offend. He was, in this rural setting, a man of substance. "For a while after independence," he said as they neared Campbell, "I tried to rebuild the inn at Quimper's Ferry. Impossible to get a holt of any money. Me, a hero in battle, a man with a good reputation, unable to find a cent." "What happened to the inn?" "Charred posts sticking out of the ground." "Were you able to sell the land?" "Sell?" Quimper turned sideways on his donkey and told Betsy Bell, "My mammy gave me one piece of solid advice. Get a holt of land and never let it go. Burn your house, even burn your Bible, but never let nobody touch your land." Judge Leander Finnessy, an unkempt, bearded man with dark, sunken eyes, that brooded as if they had witnessed all the chicanery the world could provide, had risen to become a major luminary of the Texas bar after a rather devious start. Expelled from William and Mary College in Virginia for prolonged, offensive, and noisy drunkenness, he had made his way to Georgia, where such behavior was tolerated. After marrying a local girl whose parents had acreage, he utilized his earlier schooling by reading for law. But before he was accepted by the Georgia bar, he became involved in a malodorous land fraud involving widows, and found it expedient to take his unquestioned talents farther west. Settling ultimately in the freer air of Arkansas, he announced himself as a lawyer, and when his credentials were requested, he stated simply that he had read for law in the offices of that notable Georgia jurist, Xerxes Noteworthy. When mail addressed to his supposed mentor produced no reply, Finnessy explained, "Poor man shot himself. Cancer of the esophagus." On the Arkansas frontier, he proved himself to be a good lawyer, and after notable success in helping to establish order in rough territories, he was promoted to judge. But his probate of certain wills subjected him to unfortunate scrutiny, and he deemed it best to emigrate to Texas. Here at last his deportment was circumspect, and he became, as Quimper had said, a shining light of our judicial system. Judge Finnessy held court in a one-room, dirt-floored hovel, whose only window was a rude hole covered by a piece of calf hide that had been hammered in bear grease until it became remarkably translucent. There was a table and an armchair for the judge, carved by himself, two rickety chairs for plaintiffs, and a large bucket into which the judge shot tobacco juice often and with enviable skill, for it stood some distance from the bench. Finnessy conducted trials with the aid of a heavy woven leather riding crop, which he beat furiously against his table when rendering even the simplest decision. And now, as Martin and Otto, as the principals, took the two chairs, and Yancey and Betsy Bell stood by the door, Judge Finnessy lashed about with his crop and shouted, "God damn it, is there no courtesy left in the world? Somebody give that beautiful example of Southern womanhood a chair." And after this was done, the judge explained, "For jury trials, we bring in those two benches." Smiling at the claimants, he said, "You're very fortunate, young men, to have Mr. Quimper here to guide you. The Republic of Texas was about to award him the customary 640 acres which all you heroes get, when he pointed out to the visiting land commissioner that he was entitled to rather more." He paused dramatically, and remained silent for so long that Ascot realized that a question was in order. So he asked, "How much did he get?" "Well, his dead father should have had a league and a labor from the Mexican government, but the papers were lost in the fire. He himself was assured 640 acres because of his valiant service at San Jacinto, and under our new constitution, he had head rights to his own league and labor. He gets an additional 640 for having served 6 months in the army. That made a total of 10,490 acres. Admiringly, Martin and Otto turned to nod at Yancey, who held up his hand as if to say, "Wait." The judge continued. Where Mr. Quimper showed his brilliance, he asked the commissioner and me, "Isn't the government awarding 640 acres to the heirs of anyone who died at either the Alamo or Goliad?" The commissioner said, "Yes, but your father was dead before those battles took place." And Mr. Quimper explained, "Yes, but my mother wasn't, because she died fighting off Mexican soldiers at her ferry to save General Houston's retreat. So we gave him her award, too. Total, 11,130 acres." Otto gasped. But Martin, who was fascinated by law, asked, "And what does that mean for us?" And Judge Finnessy said, "If Mr. Quimper is prepared to vouch for Mr. McNabb's heroism, I think something can be worked out." "He was more than brave," Yancey intoned. "Whenever I looked back, there he was, keeping close." "Texas wants to reward its heroes, Mr. McNabb. How old are you?" Without hesitation, Otto said, 18. "You'll probably get your height in your 20s. Many do." With Yancey providing the data, this was the settlement Judge Finnessy approved. Otto McNabb, hero of both Goliad and San Jacinto, 1,280 acres for your service in the Army for the duration of the war, plus 640 bonus for being at San Jacinto. Then for your brave father, who died at Goliad, 640 acres, plus another 320 for his service for less than 3 months in our Army. This makes a total, I believe, of 2,880 acres. So ordered." And with a majestic pursing of his lips, he arched a magisterial spray of tobacco juice right into the bucket. McNabb and Ascot were so appreciative of the way Quimper had doubled even Martin's entitlements, 1,280 acres, because of extraordinary heroism, that they entered into an agreement. "Look," Martin said, "none of us have much money. Let's work together and rebuild the inn, and then we'll build a house on your land, Otto." At this point in the discussion, Otto made a significant decision. "I don't need a house yet." "Where would you stay?" Ascot asked. And Otto said, "I could work for Yancey, maybe." And Betsy Bell cried, "Nonsense, you'll live with us." In the next weeks, the four young Texians did two things. They slaved like beasts of burden to erect at the ferry a shack which could only, by the most careless use of words, be called an inn, and they laid off the portions of land which the nation had given each of them. Quimper took a strip on the right bank of the Brazos, starting from his mother's burned inn and running south. Otto chose his adjacent to that, and Martin stepped off his, touching Otto's. When the portions were surveyed and legally transferred, Ascot told his wife one night, "Come to think of it, Yancey did all the choosing for us." And she said, with a suspicion which had started that first day when he kissed her hand, "I'm sure he expects Otto and us to clear out some day. Then he'll have it all." The work of building was arduous. Not only did everyone, including Betsy Bell, sweat in the summer sun chopping trees and sawing timbers, but at night, often on empty stomachs, they slept on bare ground. Of the many different types of tools they should have had for such a task, they had only three: two axes, a pair of good saws, and two hammers. But with these they built a cabin, through whose sides the wind and rain would whistle, and when the box-like structure was what Yancey called completed like the finest palace, they added on the south exposure a long, low porch. Quimper's ferry was back in business. With the first hard-earned dollars the foursome collected, Yancey felt he had to go to the national capital, Columbia on the Brazos, to buy the ropes and wires necessary for the reopening of a ferry service. Martin, You and Betsy Bell stay here and run the inn. Otto and me, we'll ride down and get the necessaries. When do we start our house? First things first. Let's, for God's sake, get some money around here. Each of the four realized that, from the amount of really strenuous work they had done, they should, in an orderly society, have earned large sums of cash. But, since little was circulating, they ended their labors with nothing. And the first three travelers to halt at the inn, before crossing on a pitiful little raft that Otto and Martin had built, had not a cent to pay for their keep. They did have a cow, so a barter was concluded. When Ascot wanted to know why Judge Finnessy had been so cooperative, Yancey said, "He don't get paid either. He's supposed to, but the government's got no money." "What's that have to do with it? I give him things to eat. He gives me land." On the evening before their departure for the capital, Yancey reported on a discussion he'd had with the judge. "He told me, that young feller Ascot, he seemed real bright. And when I told him you were, he said, 'Why don't he read for law?' And I asked, 'Where?' And he said, 'I'll teach him if he drops in now and then.' I asked him how much, and he said, 'Nothing. I could use a cow, and Texas could use a good lawyer.' And I asked, 'How long?' And he said, 'If he's as bright as you claim, he could do it in maybe 6 weeks.' And I said, 'You'd do it.'" The suggestion was like a rope tossed to a foundering man, for in Mississippi, before the Texas fever caught him, Ascot had been vaguely intending to study law, and his recent strenuous experience in house building had satisfied him that he was better fitted for more cerebral labors. "When could I start?" he asked eagerly. And Yancey said, "Right now. He give me these books for you to begin with." And he delivered two grease-stained books printed in London in the previous century and thumbed by young Virginians who had aspired to the courts: Blackstone's Commentaries and Coke's Institutes. Martin, taking the books reverentially, asked, "What about Betsy Bell?" And Yancey said, "She can run the inn while you study and we're gone." And in the morning, Martin went to work on Judge Finnessy's law books, while Yancey and Otto headed south to obtain equipment for the proposed ferry. Otto was disappointed in the capital of his new nation, for Columbia had only 5 houses, one of which was a store hotel. Government occupied 3 of the houses. Representatives in a 2-story frame affair with no caulking to seal the openings, senators in a windowless shack that had been used for storing cattle foodstuffs, the president in another windowless affair of 2 small rooms, a smoky fireplace, and an earthen floor that became a quagmire when water seeped in. As soon as Yancey saw the presidential mansion, his bile began to rise, and he experienced such nausea that he stopped a passerby to ask, "Is that where Sam Houston lives?" When the farmer confirmed that this was the home of the president, Quimper asked, "Is he ever sober?" And the citizen replied, "As a matter of strict truth, he is never sober before 2 in the afternoon, and since it's only 1:30, you can count on it that he lies in there dead drunk." The man said that although Houston was a famous drinker, best in these parts, past or present, his average day was orderly. "Gets drunk every night of the week at 7 and raises hell till midnight. Goes to bed about 1 in the morning, sleeps till noon, tries to sober up till 2. You can't knock him awake when he's drunk, and if the house caught fire, we'd never get him out. That gives him about 4 good working hours each afternoon, and then he does a prodigious amount running the affairs of the nation. When you catch him sober, you have yourself a very good man." "Can we leave our affairs in the hands of such a drunk?" "He handled them pretty well at San Jacinto," the farmer said, and this incited Quimper. "He was a coward, wanted to flee north to Nacogdoches. I led his troops to the fight with Santa Anna. When we got there, he refused to fight, but I moved among the troops and made him start the battle. I say, to hell with Sam Houston. Watch out, here he comes." and Yancey stared across the dusty road to the Executive Mansion, where, in mid-afternoon sun, the President of the New Republic appeared ahead of time. Standing in the low doorway, Houston was forced to stoop while he rubbed his eyes. Then he moved out onto the road, preparing to walk the short distance to where his Congress was in session. He was very tall, very powerful in appearance, but his outrageous dress made him almost a caricature of a frontier leader. On his head, he wore a George Washington tricorn hat, from whose left side projected a feather. On his feet, he had moccasins made of elk hide, with Indian beads along the high tops. What served as trousers were of a very thick homespun, no buttons, no belt, simply a huge swath of cloth wrapped about his middle and fastened with a length of rope. But it was his jacket that was most spectacular, for it consisted of a Mexican serape, brightly colored and well-fringed, which he swept about his left shoulder so that its far end dragged along the ground. Thus attired, and with a three-day growth of beard, he moved forward to conduct the affairs of state. But when he spotted Quimper, he interrupted his unsteady progress and said, without sarcasm, "Aha, the hero of San Jacinto!" Yancey, taken by surprise, fumbled for just a moment, then flashed his toothiest smile. "Good afternoon, sir." And the President of Texas lurched on, not yet fully recovered from the previous night's bout. It was on the trip home that Otto began to suspect that whatever Yancey Quimper did had to be inspected closely, because the boy could see that the enthusiastic innkeeper was apt to prove unreliable when his own interests became paramount. From something that Yancey said, "Getting the ferry started is our real job," he suspected that when the time came to help the Ascots build their house, Yancey would find other obligations to keep him employed. Otto was wrong. As soon as Yancey reached the inn, shouting to Betsy Bell as he approached, he summoned Martin, who was reading his law books, and cried, "Look what Otto and me bought for your kitchen." And to Otto's surprise, he produced a small oaken coffee grinder made in France. When Betsy Bell embraced Otto, thanking him for the gift, Yancey winked, indicating that the boy should keep his mouth shut. And next morning, it was Yancey who shouted, "Let's go down river and build that house." In the days that followed, he labored at least as strenuously as the other two men, and after many tedious days, the Ascots had their shack. Martin's advancement in his other field had been even more spectacular, for on the evening of his third visit to Judge Finnessy, the Arkansas jurist said, "Martin, I'm sending in your papers tomorrow. You're a lawyer." "But, Judge—" "Hell, son, you know more law than I do right now." And he curved yet another magnificent shot of tobacco juice into the bucket to punctuate his legal decision. When Martin expressed his gratitude for such assistance, the judge asked for the return of Coke and Blackstone, and handed him in exchange the only two books he, Finnessy, had ever purchased with his own money: Fordyce on Pleading and Civil Code of Virginia. "I never finished either of 'em, but I have found that the more you know, the better lawyer you'll be." Martin's introduction to the law came in two cases involving veterans, and since he appreciated their problems, he was a sympathetic counselor. But he learned quickly that, in the tumult of a Texas courtroom, good intentions on the part of a man's lawyer, or right on the side of a client, could mean little. In his first case, he represented a likable young farmer, Axel Vexter, who had fought at San Jacinto and had, with the approval of the Texas government, selected the 640 acres allotted him. He had surveyed the land with the aid of a licensed surveyor and had started erecting a small house when another veteran claimed prior rights. He, too, said he had governmental approval and a proper survey. The case rested, obviously, on the character and witnesses of the two contestants, and with considerable effort, Ascot rounded up proof incontrovertible that it was Vexter who had prior rights. But when Finnessy rendered his decision, the land went to the other man, and Vexter's certificate entitling him to 640 acres was available for use elsewhere. The young veteran was so infuriated by this obvious perversion of justice that he cursed Finnessy in open court and was thrown in jail for contempt. When Escott went there to console him, Vexter cursed him too and threw the certificate in his face. In vain did the young lawyer strive to assure the prisoner that he would soon be released and that other land just as good could be found. Vexter would not listen. "Take the damned land as your fee. I don't want it." This Escott would not do, and when he told Quimper about the affair, Yancey said, "Martin, when you have a case before Judge Finnessy, let me know. He owes me so many favors." Escott stared at the innkeeper. "Do you know what you just said?" And Yancey replied, "You got to accept Judge Finnessy as he is." But when Martin told Yancey about the certificate to land rights which Vexter had rejected, Quimper became quite excited. "Let me see that." And when he satisfied himself that it was a legal document, assuring the holder of free land, he said, "I need these. If you have any other clients..." He offered Martin 1 cent an acre, $6.40, to keep as a fee for services. But Martin would not accept this. "I want you to hand it to Vexter personally, so he'll know there can be decency in the law." But when the time came to count out the few coins that Betsy Bell had been collecting at the inn, Yancey could come up with only $5.10. This certificate entitled the owner to 640 acres of the choicest land in the region of the Three Rivers, land that would later be of enormous value. But because there was no money in circulation, it could not fetch even 1 cent an acre. "Will he accept 5.10?" Yancey asked. And Martin told him, "He'll be glad to get anything." So the two men went to the jail, a chicken coop affair attached to Judge Finnessy's office, and tendered Vexter the money. When he accepted, gratified by the amount, Yancey said, "If you know any others who want to sell their rights, send them to Quimper's Ferry." Then he went to the front of the building and told the judge, "Let him go. He was at San Jacinto." On his second big case, Martin Escott learned the extraordinary legal power of the words Yancey had spoken. For this time he was defending, before Judge Finnessy, a farmer of impeccable reputation and deportment, who had been grievously defrauded by a rascal named Nobby Horsham. And the case was so transparent that Escott felt he need not bother his friend Quimper, who appeared to have the judge's ear. Carefully prepared, Escott appeared on the morning of the trial date, only to find that Sam Houston, dressed in Indian garb, topped by his serape and with clanging spurs, had asked special dispensation to serve as lawyer for the defendant, despite the fact that he was the president. Judge Finnessy granted the unusual request, and the trial began. In a masterful display, young Escott deferred to the great Houston, at the same time proving beyond any doubt that Nobby Horsham had behaved despicably. The jury, 9 farmers, obviously sided with Martin's client, for some of them had been defrauded by just such rascals as Nobby. The case really did not need to be submitted to the jury, but Judge Finnessy, in a show of judicial impartiality, asked Sam Houston if he had any witnesses. "Only one, Your Honor." Limping to the witness box, his right leg dragging so conspicuously that the jury had to notice, he moved close to his client and looked down upon him as a loving father might, despite the fact that the man was a proved rascal. The audience leaned forward, expecting their voluble president to unlimber a scorching oration. But he uttered only 2 sentences. "Nobby, you've heard the serious charges made against you. Where were you on the afternoon of the 21st of April, 1836? Nobby looked up like an innocent child and whispered, "Leadin' the front line charge at San Jacinto." "The defense rests," Houston said, limping back to his chair. "Case dismissed," Judge Finnessy cried. The next months were the ones that crystallized Otto's character, for he spent them almost equally divided between the 2 contrasting lives that attracted him almost equally. he lived in the rude shack built for the Ascots, which Betsy Bell had converted into a place of warmth and illumination. As finished by the three veterans of San Jacinto, the cabin was little more than a collection of rough-cut logs piled loosely in the form of a large kitchen, a small alcove for the Ascots, and a cubbyhole for Otto. But after she finished with making it habitable, it was a snug refuge in the wilderness. First, she took Otto to the river, where they routed out long lengths of soft weeds and pailfuls of mud to caulk the crevices through which wind had been blowing and rain dripping. Then, she herself took thin, reed-like limbs of trees growing along the Brazos and fashioned them into chairs, four in all, which were both sturdy and comfortable. After what seemed like interminable searching, she procured two iron hooks for the fireplace and three pots to hang upon them. She smoothed out five successive layers of a clay-like mud to achieve a level, largely dustless floor. And to make the kitchen seem more like a city home, she nailed to its walls two colored lithographs, one sent down the Mississippi from Cincinnati, the other up across the desert from Mexico City. The first showed Andrew Jackson astride a horse at New Orleans, the second, Santa Anna, in the battle at Zacatecas. Whenever Yancey Quimper visited the kitchen, he spat at Santa Anna, whereupon Betsy Bell would bang him on the ear. To Otto, this kitchen became a university, for here the Ascots introduced him to true learning, Martin speaking of the principles of law, Betsy Bell reviewing the lessons she had mastered at a school in Mississippi. They talked of Napoleon and Charlemagne and Thomas Jefferson, and always they tried to penetrate to those motives which force men and women to behave as they do. Night after night, Martin would review cases which he had tried before Judge Finnessy, with Betsy Bell analyzing why this man and that woman had behaved as they had. "You must have seen she was lying. Surely the judge pointed this out to the jury." And Martin would explain why it was most unlikely that the judge would have done so. From such instruction, Otto began to formulate his own interpretation of society, and the Ascots might have been surprised had he revealed it. Drawing upon what he had seen at Natchez under the hill and at Goliad, he discovered that for a man to make a mark in this world, he had better have a tough core of righteousness, which he should allow nothing to scar, neither the lure of money nor the pursuit of pride. He had better identify his enemies quickly and beat them down before they had a chance to do the same to him. And it would be best if he kept quiet.